May it please the Court, Bruce Jamison on behalf of the defendants. It is my pleasure to introduce to the Court Joseph Escher of Deckard LLP. With the Court's permission, Mr. Escher will speak on behalf of the defendants today.
Welcome to the Court.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kurt Heyman for appellants, and I rise to introduce my co-counsel, Martin Stein of the Heller Horowitz firm in New York, who has been admitted pro hac vice and will be making today's argument on behalf of appellants.
Thank you, Mr. Heyman.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. There are really three issues on this appeal. First is the Rule 12b-6 dismissal of Metcalf's claim for unjust enrichment for the period prior to the Third Amendment to the merger agreement, which is approximately November 20, 2005. The second issue is the summary judgment dismissal of Metcalf's claim for work done after the Third Amendment. And the third is a dismissal on summary judgment of the plaintiff NASC's claim for reformation. I'll deal with each of these issues in that order. First, Metcalf's claim for unjust enrichment is based on the following facts as alleged in the amended complaint. Metcalf was the financial advisor and the procuring clause of the Beverly merger, which was a $2 billion transaction. The original merger agreement, which the defendant's president, Ronald Silver, was aware of even before it was signed, contained a provision, Section 5.10, which acknowledged Metcalf's right to a fee. Mr. Silver of defendants knew that NASC had no independent assets and that the Metcalf fee would have to be paid by the ultimate acquirer of Beverly out of money raised for the purchase price. The defendants, and specifically Pearl, defendant Pearl, acquired Beverly and thereby reaped the benefit of Metcalf's work. And the complaint alleges that Metcalf conferred a benefit directly on the defendants. And finally, the complaint alleges that the defendants knew, following the Third Amendment, that NASC would not be able to pay the Metcalf fee, and that absent the recovery against the defendants, Metcalf will not be paid anything.
Mr. Now, Stein,
yes.
With regard to this subject in your brief, I think it's on page 23, you make reference to the fact that Metcalf was reimbursed more than $1 million in expenses by the defendants for work done prior to the Third Amendment.
Yes.
It's not clear to me who paid that, when they paid it, or why they paid it.
Well, the amended complaint alleges that it was paid in December. There is evidence in the record that it was for work done in October, which was prior to the defendant, and that money was paid by Fillmore, which is a parent of the defendant, Pearl.
And why did they pay that? Does the record reflect that?
The record on the motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6 does not reflect it. The amended complaint simply alleges that that money was paid for expenses by Metcalf in connection with work.
I read that. How about on the expanded record that led to summary judgment? Do we get any more insight into why that was paid?
Well, there is some evidence that it was paid, that it was reimbursement of some money paid by Metcalf for legal work to the Troutman Sanders law firm. That is part of the expanded record on the motion for summary judgment. But if we're going to consider, I submit, the evidence on the motion for summary judgment in connection with the motion to dismiss, there's obviously a lot more evidence which shows or which certainly underscores the validity of the claim for unjust enrichment.
I understand. The reason I wanted to talk about this at the beginning of your argument is to get a sense of the entire case. Your opponent's position is Metcalf's entitled to nothing,
right.
Period.
Right.
We now have it undisputed in the record that someone decided to give them $1 million for expenses, notwithstanding the fact that they were entitled to nothing. In your brief, you make the argument that if they were entitled to expenses for the work they did, they were entitled to be paid for the work they did, all of which seems logical. But at least based on this record, I still can't discern why the money was paid.
Well, Your Honor, I think that we are entitled to the reasonable inference, certainly on the 12B6 motion, that it was paid in connection with the work done, and therefore it's an acknowledgement that since the expenses were paid, it's an acknowledgement that MedCap is certainly entitled to go forward with this case to prove that it is also entitled to payment on a claim of unjust enrichment for the work that it was done. Particularly, Your Honors, since this court has adopted a very, very broad standard for the elements of unjust enrichment.
Does the record reflect that prior to November 20th, 2005, MedCap worked exclusively for NASC?
MedCap didn't work exclusively. MedCap is a separate broker-dealer and an investment banker. MedCap worked on the transaction, but Mr. Silva was involved in the transaction even before the original merger agreement. Mr. Silva was not someone who's walking down the street and he sees a magician and the magician entertains him and passes around the hat. Mr. Silva was involved in the transaction from the beginning. He knew that MedCap was involved in the transaction from the beginning. He signed on to the transaction with the knowledge that MedCap was working on it, that MedCap expected a fee, that MedCap was continuing to do work on it. And he's not simply some kind of a spectator here. And he reaped the benefit of that work because it was his company that ultimately acquired Beverly.
Let me get a good handle on what the vice chancellor did that you believe was error. Did he misconstrue our law on unjust enrichment?
Well,
or did he misread the complaint and not give the facts stated in the complaint all the justice they deserve?
I think it's both of those, Your Honor. First of all, the vice chancellor said in so many words that there has to be a direct relationship between, in this case, MedCap and Mr. Silva or Mr. Silva's company, or there has to be a request, because work done at the behest of another is not compensable under unjust enrichment. Now, there is no such case which states that. There has to be a relationship between the enrichment and the impoverishment, and you have that here because work was done by MedCap for which it will not be paid, which is the same as money being spent for which it will not be repaid. And the relationship between the impoverishment and the enrichment in this case is that Mr. Silva reaped the benefits of MedCap's work. So you have that relationship. There's no case in Delaware law that holds, particularly on a motion to dismiss, that there has to be an allegation in the complaint of a request by the defendant of the plaintiff to do the work. There is no Delaware case law which says that at all. But second, Your Honors, even if Vice Chancellor was correct, there were several facts, I believe, which would have brought this case within the rule that the Vice Chancellor set forth. First of all, there was evidence in the record. It's not alleged in the complaint, but it was before the Vice Chancellor on the motion for a Rule 12b-6 dismissal. There was evidence in the record, and I put it in my brief, that Mr. Silva knew that Mr. Grunstein was a principal of MedCap. Now, Mr. Silva was dealing with Mr. Grunstein for months, and the complaint says that he knew that Mr. Grunstein was a principal of MedCap. So if a relationship, a direct relationship, is needed, there it was. Now, the defendants are going to argue, well, there was nothing in the record on the motion to dismiss which shows that Mr. Silva knew of this relationship prior to the Third Amendment. However, we are entitled on a motion to dismiss to the inference that the knowledge was obtained prior to the Third Amendment. And that's particularly true since this dichotomy between the pre-Third Amendment and the post-Third Amendment was never even argued by the defendants on the motion. The Vice Chancellor came up with that on his own. Nobody was arguing pre-post. It was all one ball of wax. So when there is evidence before the Vice Chancellor that says Mr. Silva knew that Mr. Grunstein was in effect Medcap, we're entitled to the inference that he knew about that from day one. So in response to Your Honor's question, there was a misconstruing of the law as well as the fact that a misconstruing of the facts as well. I'd like to turn for a moment to the summary judgment with respect to the unjust enrichment. I think that it's pretty clear. One other fact I'd like to mention before I get to that. There was also an October 18th budget which was sent 1 month prior to the Third Amendment to Mr. Silva, who was actively involved in the transaction. That budget included a line item, not just for Medcap expenses, it included a line item for the Medcap fee. This was done before the Third Amendment. It's alleged in the complaint. Now, the amount of the fee was left blank, but the presence of the line item in that budget sent to Mr. Silva is also an implicit acknowledgement of Medcap's right to receive a fee, which admittedly took place prior to the Third Amendment. Turning now to the motion for summary judgment on the unjust enrichment claim, I think it's pretty clear, and I don't understand that the defendants dispute, but I think if the dismissal on Rule 12b-6 with respect to the pre-Third Amendment claim is reversed, as we believe it should be, then automatically the summary judgment on the post-Third Amendment also would have to be reversed. First of all, a different legal standard would probably govern, but then there would also be no basis for distinguishing between the pre-Third Amendment and the post-Third Amendment, and therefore facts relevant to pre-Third Amendment work, authorizations, requests, and so on, would be relevant to the post-Third Amendment as well. But even if there were no reversal of the 12b-6 dismissal, the post-Third Amendment dismissal would also have to be reversed for the following reasons. First of all, we presented evidence on the motion for summary judgment of the partnership agreement between Mr. Grunstein and Mr. Silva, which included any company that was to be formed for the future. And therefore, if Mr. Grunstein hires Medcap, he does so on behalf of Mr. Silva as well. Then we have the conversation between Brink Dickerson and Joseph Heil, the attorney for Deckert, on the evening of November 21st, where Mr. Heil asks Mr. Dickerson to take out the parenthetical referring to payment to Medcap for its work, and he says to Mr. Dickerson, "We don't want to screw anybody, we just want to make a fair deal." There could be no clearer example of an acknowledgement of an entitlement by Medcap to be paid a fee by the defendants than that. And third, the evidence on discovery shows admissions by Mr. Silva that prior to the Third Amendment, he worked directly with Medcap with respect to the merger. This all shows that the work post-Third Amendment and payment for that work was authorized and acknowledged before the Third Amendment. Now, obviously, this discovery evidence was also relevant to pre-Third Amendment claim. However, since we didn't have the benefit of discovery, some of this evidence, obviously, was not in, and it was not alleged in the complaint. But the point is, this evidence that was adduced on discovery shows the wisdom of the rule that a 12b-6 dismissal will not be granted unless there's no reasonably conceivable set of circumstances which would justify a recovery by the plaintiff. Finally, with respect to the dismissal of the claim for reformation, I'd like to make the following brief points. First, There was clearly a genuine issue of fact as to whether Mr. Dickerson was representing both sides to the transaction. And by both sides, I mean NASC and the defendants. Ronald Silva acknowledged it. That's at page A521 of the appendix. And Mr. Dickerson himself wrote it in an email. He said, yes, we represent Fillmore, which was Mr. Silva's company, and we probably answer to Deckard as well. Now, this court in the Craft Builders case said, and I quote, representation of both parties places a heavy burden upon an attorney. During the period of his representation, he was duty-bound to see that there was full disclosure and full protection for both parties. Third, we submit that knowledge of a dual agent does not get imputed to both sides, even in the absence of self-interest by the agent. However, if self-interest is required, we believe it is present in spades here. This is not simply a case of an attorney hoping to be paid a fee. Here, the Troutman Sanders firm was owed $4 million, and there is evidence in the record that the only way it was hoping to get paid its fee is if this deal closed. In order for this deal to close, Mr. Silva's company had to come into the deal. Therefore, they had a tremendous financial incentive to please Mr. Silva at the expense of their other client, in this case, NASC. Fourth, here we're not just talking about imputing knowledge of a dual agent to both sides. We're talking about a dual agent making a change from a previous draft, which would shift a liability of possibly up to $20 million from one of his clients to the other client. And this change came about after one of his clients had gone home for the night thinking that the deal was over. Now, an argument can be made, and the defendants have made the argument, and frankly, the vice chancellor agreed with it, that there was a waiver, consent, etc., by Mr. Grunstein and Mr. Goldsmith of NASC. But there was a waiver of a conflict so long as the interests coincided. There was no waiver of any conflict where the interests would diverge. And those interests diverged at 12:59 a.m. on the morning of November 21st, when the new amendment came about, which deleted the parenthetical and the reference to the Metcalf fee. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Joe Escher for the appellees. The appellant's theories of recovery in this and the related Grunstein action are a chameleon that keeps changing its skin. And they keep changing their theories, and they've argued this morning a whole bunch of things that they never argued below in the Metcalf case, and they've argued some things that they're still arguing in the Grunstein case. And the status of that case now is that there is a motion to dismiss that's under submission in front of Vice Chancellor Noble. I'd like to address Justice Holland's question about the payment of the expenses to Metcalf. As my opponent recognized, the reimbursement of payments to Metcalf was on account of monies that Metcalf had paid to the Troutman Sanders firm, which after the Third Amendment was then retained by the new acquirer, Pearl Senior Care, and Pearl Senior Care paid those expenses. Now, that's plainly explicable in terms of, number one, fairness. Number two, the fact that Troutman Sanders was now representing Pearl Senior Care and is also implicated in issues having to do with whether there was some sort of oral partnership between Mr. Grunstein and Mr. Silva, or some entity associated with Mr. Silva, or some other person like Mr. Dwyer, which is the theory or alternative theories that are being argued in the Grunstein action, which is not the case that's in front of you this morning. So there are explanations for why that could happen. I would also respectfully submit that there's no necessary connection between the reimbursement of Metcalf's expenses and forcing an agreement on Pearl Senior Care to pay Metcalf's investment banking fee of $20 million.
Well, let's just look at the motion to dismiss posture, though. Mm-hmm. If Metcalf was incurring expenses, and we'll call them these legal fees, mm-hmm. in doing this alleged work, if they're going to be reimbursed for their expenses, why shouldn't they, even on a quantum merit basis, get paid for what they did that would related to the expenses they incurred?
I think the reason is that there was never any agreement to pay them for the investment banking fee, Your Honor. That's the point. It isn't a there's a disconnect between the equitable decision to reimburse them for their expenses, which in the Grunstein action they're arguing is a is evidence that there is some sort of oral partnership agreement between Mr. Silva and Mr. Grunstein. There's a disconnect between that and suggesting that somehow Metcalf's $20 million investment banking fee was agreed to be paid by some defendant.
I understand that, and I'm not suggesting that mm-hmm. they would be entitled to $20 million or they would be entitled to anything. What I'm trying to understand, given our motion to dismiss standards, if they can allege in the complaint we're entitled to be paid something for our work, and we can demonstrate that someone else thought we were entitled to be paid because they paid for our expenses, why shouldn't they withstand a motion to dismiss?
I think the answer, Your Honor, is actually it's a fundamental point, and it's the one that the Vice Chancellor recognized, which is Restatement of Restitution, Section 110, that basically says that if you've got a contract with Party A and it turns out Party A can't pay you, that by itself is not a reason to make Party C pay you, because Party A couldn't pay you, even if Party C gets a benefit under the performance that you provided under Contract A. And it's actually a very important point, Your Honor, that the decision on the motion to dismiss was based on this Restatement Section 110, citing the Chilibillies case that Vice Chancellor Noble cited to, that was the basis for the decision on the motion to dismiss. And this notion of whether there had been a prior request by any of the defendants, that's really an issue for consideration under the notion of whether the benefit had been officiously conferred under Restatement Section 112. It's a different section of the restatement, and I think that the appellants here have tried to conflate those two notions in arguing that somehow the allegation that there was an express agreement should have been considered in connection with the motion to dismiss, which was really decided on the Section 110 issue. Of course, they did not incorporate the express agreement allegation into the allegations having to do with unjust enrichment because, of course, Your Honor, if there was an express agreement, then there couldn't be quantum merit recovery, and they've even cited to a case that stands for that proposition in their reply brief. That's the Collins and Aikman case. I think that's Exhibit 2 to their reply brief. Another point that I think is really worth mentioning, Your Honors, is that when appellants tried to describe the facts of the case, what they left out was the most important fact of all, which is that there is a written advisory agreement between NASC and Metcalf. That's the center of this case, and they didn't even mention it in describing what the facts were. And, of course, the reason for that is that is the crux of what's wrong with their case. They had an agreement with NASC. NASC was the entity that had agreed to acquire Beverly Enterprises, Inc. NASC was the entity that signed the merger agreement. When Metcalf was doing its work, it was doing that work for NASC. That's what the contract says, and NASC was the entity that was acquiring Beverly. It's not until the Third Amendment that that Pearl Senior steps in the place of NASC. Now, that's why the Vice Chancellor Noble's decision on the motion to dismiss was so correct and so carefully reasoned, Your Honors, because what he recognized is that prior to the Third Amendment, that the written contract, the advisory agreement between NASC and MetCap governed that relationship. And he said, well, there may be an issue of fact as to whether there's unjust enrichment under Section 110 of the restatement after the Third Amendment. But then when he was presented with the evidence on the summary judgment motion, he determined that any benefit that was conferred after the Third Amendment was done so officiously under Section 112 of the Restatement of Restitution, because plaintiffs and appellants here had conceded that there was no request, coercion, or mistake which would justify a restitutionary relief in a context like this one under Section 112 of the restatement. So the critical piece of evidence in the case is this signed, I would submit, essentially.
But the other side doesn't make that concession today, do they?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
That there's no requests or facts that would support a request.
I, to tell you the truth, Your Honor, I'm really not sure what their position is with respect to that. I think that they argued in connection with the motion to dismiss that the issue of request fell non was irrelevant. They expressly did not include the allegation of an express agreement as incorporating by reference in the unjust enrichment count. They never raised it in connection with the argument on the motion to dismiss. They didn't raise it in connection with the motion for reconsideration on the motion to dismiss. And they didn't present any evidence of a request either before or after the Third Amendment on the summary judgment motion. So,
well, let's assume that they've changed their position on that point. How should we deal with that?
I think that you should ignore their attempt to change their position at this point, and that's inconsistent with all good appellate practice for them to change their position yet again. Your Honors, we're on the eighth complaint in this litigation in total. There have been eight complaints so far of the plaintiffs here trying to come up with a theory for them to get money somehow in the case. And I would respectfully suggest that it's inconsistent with every notion of proper jurisprudence for them to be able to come up here now and say, well, actually, what I'd really like to do is to argue that there was a request before the Third Amendment. Of course, then we'd have the arguments that the Third Amendment would bar any evidence of that because there's a disclaimer and representation and warranty and integration clause in the Third Amendment. And I would also raise the point, Your Honor, that any allegation of a request prior to the Third Amendment would be by an entity that isn't even a defendant in this case, because the only defendant that's remaining on the unjust enrichment count is Pearl Senior Care, which was created hours before the Third Amendment was entered into. So I just can't even imagine what the allegation by that Pearl Senior Care requested the services of MetCap prior to the Third Amendment would be. But in any event, it's much too late, Your Honor. That's my position. Okay? If I could go a little bit to talking about the Reformation claim. I think the Reformation claim is extraordinarily meritless, Your Honors. There was no evidence that there was an undisclosed conflict here. All of the players here are highly sophisticated. We're talking about three or four partners at the Troutman Sanders firm who are interacting with each other. They are wearing many, many hats at once. Mr. Grunstein is wearing a MetCap hat. He's wearing an NASC hat. He's wearing a Troutman Sanders hat. And now he's claiming that his partner at Troutman Sanders, who he delegated the authority to negotiate the transaction, that somehow that he exceeded his authority But that's not an undisclosed conflict. Any notion that that the simple hope of getting paid on your past due attorney's fees would constitute enough to constitute a conflict so that a clear decision by an attorney who was the primary negotiator of the document could somehow be disregarded after the fact is the worst kind of policy decision imaginable. How could anybody have any certainty or faith in the ability to rely on what's in the written documents if that were the case? That's really an impossible standard. I think that there are quite a few issues of waiver with respect to any of the arguments that they didn't raise below are waived, Your Honors, and they did not raise the argument that there was an express request for Metcalf's services by Pearl Senior Care or any of the other defendants prior to the Third Amendment. They didn't make that argument below. They weren't caught sleeping on this, Your Honor. We made the Section 110 argument under the restatement of restitution. The Vice Chancellor accepted that argument, and he ruled in our favor, but he only ruled in our favor with respect to the pre-Third Amendment based on the existence of the advisory agreement itself. And he said that there was an issue of fact after the Third Amendment. There wasn't anything unfair about that. He didn't decide the motion to dismiss based on the Section 112 issue. He plainly cited to Section 110 of the Restatement of Restitution and to the controlling decision in the Chilibillies case. Now, with respect to the sufficiency of the allegations, I know that my opponent has relied quite a bit on the street search decision, which is just a trial court decision, Your Honor, in completely different factual circumstances where there's an entity that's just acting as a middleman. It's a determination about the sufficiency of unjust enrichment allegations based on very, very little analysis that we can actually see on the face of the opinion. It's in no way controlling on this court, and it's not even persuasive or really even on point. So, Your Honor, we think that Vice Chancellor Noble's decision was extraordinarily well-reasoned, very thoughtful. Both the motion to dismiss and the motion for summary judgment were decided based on a painstaking analysis of the facts and the applicable law and should be affirmed. If Your Honors have any other further questions, I'd be happy to address them now.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, the motion to dismiss was decided on the basis of no request and no direct relationship, not on the basis of Section 110 of the Restatement. Section 110 of the Restatement says that an unjust enrichment claim will not lie merely because a party to a contract has not paid. But that merely language doesn't preclude unjust enrichment when there was, in fact, an agreement between two other parties. And, in fact, the defendants don't even recognize the existence of that agreement between Metcalf and NASC. Your Honor, the work that was being done for everybody, regardless of who the written advisory agreement was between. The work that was being done for everybody involved in the transaction, including Mr. Silva. Mr. Silva was there before the merger agreement was drafted. He didn't just waltz in at the end. He was there from the beginning. And to say that Pearl, the defendant, was formed at the end, that's disingenuous because it's very clear from the Arcadia case, which I cite in our brief, that a subsequently formed incorporation is bound by the acts of its incorporator when the subsequently formed corporation had knowledge. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. In terms of the Metcalf reimbursement for expenses, defendants can't have it both ways. They can't argue, well, based on the motion for summary judgment, evidence, it's clear that that was reimbursement of a legal fee. If you're going to consider the motion, the evidence on the motion for summary judgment in connection with the Rule 12b-6 dismissal, then you also have to consider the fact that Mr. Heil says, we don't want to screw anybody. We want to make a fair deal. We want to negotiate a fair deal. Isn't that relevant to the pre- and post-Third Amendment work? Also, Mr. Escher said that there was no agreement between the defendants and Metcalf. Well, that's what Quantum Merowith is all about, the absence of an express agreement. Finally, the two cases that we do cite, Street Search and the Reserves case, are absolutely relevant to this case on facts far, far less compelling. In Street Search, the motion to dismiss was denied, and in Reserves, even after trial, Quantum Merowith unjust enrichment was awarded. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.